Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you and present our interdisciplinary project. It brings together a political scientist, Helen Callaghan, from the Max Planck Institute, an economist, Angelo Riva, based in Paris, and a sociologist, me. Together, we articulate three different perspectives: the politics of corporate governance, the sociology of financial markets, and the political economy of finance. So, what is the research agenda? Drawing from Strick 2009, our goal is to identify mechanisms of change in specific contexts. Therefore, our approach emphasizes on a historical perspective to analyze financial markets as institutions that are the contested byproducts of three things: individual actions, collective mobilizations, and public policy. What is the case study about? Our case study is about the process of stock market demutualization that profoundly transformed over the past three decades the stock exchange industry at large and the two main continental European exchanges in particular, Frankfurt and Paris. What are our main findings? At odds with analysis that consider innovation as the main driving force for change, we demonstrate in the case of the transformation of the stock exchange industry that innovation is only one resource among others in competitive fields that remain largely shaped by political agency. To put it differently, public actors unleashed competition in which innovation is one efficient resource among others. Well, so what is demutualization and why does it matter? Long organized on a mutual basis, stock exchanges were run as monopolies. The stock exchange, particularly in Europe, was organized as monopolies by virtues of their quasi-public dimension. Starting with the Big Bang in London in 1986, the main European bourses have demutualized. In addition to adopting privatized status and becoming profit-driven private companies, they put themselves up for auction at the beginning of this millennium on the market they operate. This dual process of corporatization and privatization was supposed to transform exchanges into real companies that could compete fair and square with private transnational trading platforms. In consequence, stock exchanges went from being forum for public competition to privatized players in private competition. This is demutualization. And it's a three-step process. The first process was incorporation. The second one was the IPO, and the last step was the sale of the shares by the former owner users. Why does it matter? At the governance level, we witnessed a disruption of network-based coordination, which ended with management crisis or unintended strategic move. At the industry level, the inherited positions of traditional stock exchange have raised monopoly issues, especially in the European context. And at the regulatory level, demutualization also raises tremendous challenges. Some exchanges, weighted down by the cost inherent in their constitutional obligations in terms of market surveillance or transparency, are beginning to pass through to issuers the cost that used to be covered by trading fees. They're also acquiring alternative trading platforms, further blurring the boundaries between regulated market and OTC activities. Some of these exchanges may even be considering abandoning their regulated status at some point. They would no longer be subject to the attendant regulatory obligations and could compete on an even footing with their rivals, who are governed by far less stringent regulations. If we focus on the demutualization of the main German exchange, Frankfurt, we see the decrease of strategic holding in the capital of Deutsche Börse by German banks, and the parallel rise of foreign investors, mainly pension, mutual or hedge funds. This dramatic change became critical when the bosses of Deutsche Börse were forced to resign in 2005 by a majority of shareholders which opposed their strategy to merge with the London Stock Exchange at that time. In the case of the Paris Stock Exchange, the consequences of demutualizations were even bigger Since 2008, the Paris Stock Exchange has become a subsidiary of the NYSE group, which is quite a surprise for such a dirigist country as France, in which economic patriotism seems anchored to economic policy. For those interested in this intriguing counterexample, come and attend Helen's presentation this afternoon at 3:30. So, the idea was to first to challenge the mainstream explanations and to show their limits. So the mainstream explanation failed to predict the actual outcomes of demutualization. According to the optimality of market coordination view, demutualization ought to have made it easier to resolve the problem of governance between intermediaries and exchanges. In addition, going public was supposed to allow exchanges to raise the capital they needed to pay for technological investments. The IT revolution view, which is the second main mainstream explanation, argues that that remote access profoundly changed the stock exchange industry. It would have necessarily implied the dismantlement of the local arrangement that could not cope with rocketing volume since the 80s. Yet, historically speaking, the computerization of both the Frankfurt and the Paris Stock Exchange were first implemented to preserve local arrangement. And moreover, please remember that the exchange traded volume in comparison to the GDP was higher before the First World War than nowadays. In Paris, for instance, we calculated that the daily volume was three times the French GDP compared to once at the dawn of the new millennium. In this setup, competition between demutualized and computerized exchanges and alternative trading platforms would generate greater liquidity than mutually owned exchanges, making it possible to build a genuine market-based financial system. That was the idea. What are the predicted and actual outcome of the demutualization? Competition was supposed to reduce trading costs, which it in turn would enhance market liquidity and make it cheaper for issuers to raise capital. In fact, trading fees were slashed, but it only benefited the bigger intermediaries, which capture the extra profits. The liquidity was not increased, and we now observe its fragmentation among exchanges and alternative trading venues. To put it simply, it means that it has become more and more difficult for a company or an investor to know the price of its or his or her shares. So, what is our explanation? Well, our explanation is the following. The political impetus was similar in France and Germany, and if you are interested in the French case, you have to go back in the 1980s. If you're interested in the German case, you have to go back to the years just after the reunifications. In 1980s France, the government struggled against inflation and therefore decided to reform the national financial systems. In 1990s, Germany, in order to contain inflation caused by reunification, also triggered the development of a national-based market for an internationally marketable public debt. In both countries, the government promoted the transformation of the national markets to prevent London from becoming the one and only place to trade public German or French bonds. That is the first drive, the national political impetus. The second one was the business drive. In both countries, the capture of intermediation profits by banks against local intermediaries explained the original alliance between the former and the government to transform the governance of stock exchanges. Between the late 90s and the mid-90s, stock exchanges ceased to be perceived by banks as strategic holdings. In France, this change coincides with the dismantlement of les noyaux durs, hard cores, which used to structure and integrate the French corporate microcosm. And in Germany, the focus on core activities and the consequential disinvestment in non-strategic shareholdings were even fueled by the decision of the Schröder government, which declared tax-free the profit induced by disinvestment in subsidiaries or non-core business firms. In both countries, that thrive to cash in short-term profits after the dot-com bubble burst in 2001 only precipitated this dynamics. In the notice, you have another political drive, which is no more national but EU-driven. And it's the EU impetus which replaced the national political drive. This impetus culminated in fall 2007 with the entry into force of the Market and Financial Instrument Directive. This directive replaced the Valresian market model based on network-based arrangements with a kind of market for market. The idea of this directive was to create a market for markets. So, what can we learn from the case study? At the policy-making level, what we try to understand is this kind of sources-apprentice sequence. In fact, the governments, both in France and Germany, have reoriented since the 1980s their national financial systems from a credit base to a more financial market type of economy. To fight back inflation, they decided to play the market. But doing so, they dismantle the institutional setting that contained the expansion as well as the disruptive power of financial market. At the industry level, demutualization disrupted local arrangements on behalf of efficiency through competition, but the new institutional setting hardly meets the publicized objectives of its promoters and lacks the stability provided by the previous one. At the organizational level, we could consider that it might be the end of the very concept of exchanges. They are morphing from institution organizing public competition between financial intermediaries into for-profit companies competing with one another and with their main users to provide financial intermediation services. Therefore, we try to provide a non-teleological analysis of institutional change, which happens to be neither a rational public choice, not an ideological conspiracy, nor an IT fate. What is the broader lessons? That the political impetus at the national and then at the EU level framed the competitive arena in which technological innovation was one resource among others. Thank you very much.
It seems to me better to have comments for each paper because they are in different fields. So I think they address a broader common concern, but probably you have some specific questions.
Basically, you're focusing on the issue of regulatory changes, which obviously made the space for doing this. But that, I guess what I'm wondering is the fragmentation of these markets, while the regulatory framework allows for it, the large institutional customers are creating it. Have you looked at that at all? That it's the large basically, that fragmentation, a lot of it's coming from large institutions moving off exchange and going to alternative trading platforms. And have you looked at that dynamic of why they're moving that direction and how that plays into the whole picture that you're painting?
Two things. First of all, I mean, there's a kind of European bias in the presentation, which means that in Europe, until the implementation of this directive, in some in continental Europe, there was this rule of concentration of order flows, which means yes. That there was a kind of de facto monopoly for the incumbent stock exchanges. Mm-hmm. And it is a regulatory process to dismantle this rule and to promote a new organization. I do agree with you that, of course, the bigger players, as they have always an interest into a fragmented market because they are the only one capable to recreate the entire information that you need to make your investment decisions.
Because the same movement is happening, or has been happening in the U.S., yeah. And now they're starting to try to bring these platforms to Asia Pacific as well.
Yeah,
so
I suppose that, I mean, this is going to be there's going to be a kind of global relocation. Some government or political institution try to develop this system because at one point in their history they have like convergent interests with like the bigger players. In Europe, it was definitely the fight against inflation, and like fight against inflation implied that you need to have non-inflationary modes of funding your expenses, and the way to do so is to have a tradable public debt, and to have a tradable public debt, you need to strike an arrangement with the bigger players. That explained the first move. Generally speaking, after some years, we might expect that the politicians discover or rediscover the fact that the concentration on one exchange has some benefits because it's easier to control, it's easier to regulate. And of course, I suppose that the bigger players will change from the US to Europe and then from Europe to South Asian Pacific to have these platforms. The interesting thing for us is that at the very moment when the EU countries, and especially France and Germany, are more and more into re-regulation of financial activities, these questions is not addressed at all, which is really, really, really strange, because you could easily argue that the question of how do you trade is crucial in the regulation process.
I'm quite surprised to, especially sociologists, political scientists, I suppose. That's my specialty. Taking for granted the argument of inflation. It is a classic Chicago argument applied to Argentina and Brazil in the 70s, and probably raised by some government in British and Iran and Europe. I'm not sure about Germany and France, I think.
But so,
why do you not try to figure out a more sophisticated framework of analysis about this particular thing?
And
the second point is about the European Union process. I mean, it's probably complementary to that one. Because when I look at the country regulation, the process was much more complicated than this. I know you are another player of that market, so you probably have the same problem with this kind of regulations.
Concerning the first point on inflation, I mean, I suppose that, which is sure, I mean, I'm sure that the argument, let's say that the question of inflation was used in critical moments, both in Germany and France, to foster financial deregulation. Among the people who promoted this deregulation, some were absolutely convinced, ideologically speaking, but the vast majority of the people from the Treasury in France, for instance, were not that. they were not into this super monetarist view. The problem is that basically they had a very technical view on stock exchange. They do consider that stock exchange is a kind of neutral technical arrangement. So they thought that, okay, you just change the way you trade the public debt, it's going to ease us at a critical moment, and but it won't change the whole picture, which was not the case. The other thing is that if you really look at the chronology very very precisely, the moment when these decisions were taken were really moments where the great national balances were under threat. So it doesn't mean that the monetarist view was wrong. I mean that they were right, but at that time, at that precise moment, they could be very vocal. They could be very vocal. Concerning the EU, well, that's something that we discuss with Ellen a lot, is the fact that our position is backed basically by the work from Elliot Posner, that the previous work by Nicolas Jabot, and they both explained the fact that the EU drive becomes very important at the dawn of the millennium, but not before. I mean, the first move was not driven by EU. If you look at, for instance, the law in France that deregulated financial markets, you have no mention of the Europe, I mean, the EU level before the late 90s. This is not the point. The question is the reform of the financial system from a credit base to a more financial markets oriented system in order to provide new means to raise capital to or to fund the public expenditures. But there's no, you have to wait till the late 90s, and in fact you have to wait for the implementation in France of the first directive on the investment services to see this European impetus.
Thank you very much for a very clear presentation. You were just mentioning the EU drive, but what is driving the EU? I mean, there are a lot of actors trying to influence EU policy, member states, companies. So how do you explain this very strong emergence of the EU as a driver in this process?
I would have like an analytical analyst, and I have an answer and a more anecdotal one. I used to be a trainee working for the Paris Stock Exchange, and I was sent to Brussels to do lobbying. And one I met someone working for the London Stock Exchange, and he explained to me, well, it's like in Brussels, it's very simple. You French people, you decided to have like your agribusiness thing, you put a lot of money on it, you got it. We decided to have the city, we got the city. And that's sure, that's obvious. At the more analytical level, I would say that yes, of course, when you see this directive, the Market for Financial Instrument Directive, was really captured by 10 big financial institutions. And the key, I would say that the key figure that you have to keep in mind is the fact that basically you have 200 financial institutions in Europe that provide services across Europe. But you only have 10 institutions that makes 3/4 of the volumes. And among these 10 institutions, the only European one is the London-based branch of the Deutsche Bank. So yes, the EU drive is not free from private interference, of course.
Just a brief question and brief answer.
I'm trying to make some connections between what you're discussing and the development of a private bond market in Europe, which didn't exist 20 years ago and now is probably trade bonds bigger than that in this country. So does your story seems to hinge on policy respecting the development of market-intermediated credit in Europe. Why did the mutual mode of governance and ownership of stock exchanges, how did that stand in the way of the development of the bond? Did they just not have the capacity?
Two things. At the organizational level, there was a capacity constraint. In France and in Germany, the brokers were very, very small. So they were not capable to sustain the issuing of a big amount of capital. It was just not possible. So basically, for the government, there were two options. Either you accept the fact that all these things would be done in London by bigger institution, or you try to have your own big institution. That's what they tried to do. Thing is that like, because of regulatory arbitrage, most of these big companies, even if they were French, decided to move to London. The other thing is that the way, it's a bit more technical, but the way public debt is issued.
This is public debt or private debt?
Yeah.
Corporate bonds.
Yeah. For corporate bonds, the thing is that there was a failed attempt by exchanges to keep private bonds on their markets. The problem was that the financial intermediaries in France and Germany was too small to be able to find foreign buyers for these bonds. So at one point, the only option for the companies was either to go to London or to force the government to reform the way the national markets were created. Just to have an idea, in France, for instance, until 1988, there was a strict monopoly with a bunch of 100 guys. It was kind of like old school partnership. No more than 100 people working in each brokerage house, and it was forbidden for them to have like offices abroad because of the strict control of capital.
So counterfactually, that mode of ownership and governance was not going to survive whatever the government.
The thing is that if you accept that the only way to do counterfactual design in social sciences is basically to do history. You go back to the heyday of the Paris Stock Exchange before the First World War. Same organizations, and they traded much more foreign bonds than they now trade foreign bonds in Paris. And if you look at the volumes compared to the GDP, it was three times before the First World War and only one time today. So it's not true that this institution could not make it. The very difference is that at that time, this institution they didn't have the pressure, the competitive pressure from big banks. Relatively speaking, their organization was, before the First World War, the group of the Paris Stock Exchange workers were bigger than the Crédit Lyonnais, which were the biggest French banks. So they could compete. The very difference is that you had all over the 20th century, the creation of and the inflation of big banks that at one point were capable to push them away. And for the bank, the key idea was, and the key drive was to recapture financial intermediation profit. And that's what they did with the big bank and with the financial deregulation. So I don't think that this organization was condemned, that was doomed to fail, because historically speaking, you can see moments in history where it coped with bigger volumes and bigger openness. At that time, before the First World War, there was no control at all on foreign capital movements.